up sound. Pioneer speakers bumping as I step on the pound. I got the sound for you, and it's easy to see that this DJ B.
Future is Now is a podcast series exploring intersections between art and social change. Produced by Zed Galleries, Sharzad Arshadi, and Caroline Künzli. The title comes from a song by German punk rock singer Nina Hagen. She sings, 1968 is over, it's over. Future is now. It's really going to be a better world. Her lyrics express our feeling that change for a better world is happening right now through the work of many. In each episode, Future is Now will tell you these stories of change, stories of artists and art projects that inspire us. As you listen, we hope these stories will inspire you too.
Future is now.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. Soldiers, the misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress.
Not one man, nor a group of men, but in all men, in you, you, the people, have the power. The power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world. That will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future, and old age a
certainty. We are living in a world overwhelmed by injustice, disaster, tragedy, hunger, war, forced displacements. Ecological destruction and industrial catastrophes threaten our daily life. We have to remind ourselves constantly, with all this technological progress, why do many of us around the world still live in misery? Technology didn't bring us happiness, not because it's bad, but because I believe it is in the hands of the wrong, greedy 1% who are trying to do everything possible to control us and to steal from us. We, the 99%, if we don't realize soon how powerful we can be together, if we don't fight for our common goals, for our common hopes and dreams for a better world, all we will leave behind for the future generations is misery and destruction. Our silence has given our fate to the hands of those who are breathing with greed, war, and catastrophe. Hello. Hello, welcome to Future Is Now. I'm Shahrzad Arshadi. In this episode, I'm focusing on our hopes and dreams. What is the future we are wishing to live or wishing to leave behind for our children and grandchildren and the generations after us? For this, I ask different people to record their voice in order to share their hopes and dreams with us, a beautiful collage. Many of us have been experienced atrocities by living through wars, brutal fundamentalist revolutions, dictatorship, political repressions, and corrupted regimes and unwanted migration. I am one of those people. Time passes, whether I want to or not. I'm getting old, and it makes me so sad to think this is the world I am leaving behind for my grandchildren. It makes me think more than ever that we must do something to stop this brutal machine. And this episode is a little trigger, at least for some of us, to think about the future and to dream. Maybe by talking about our hopes and dreams, we realize, I mean our collective we, deserve a better life than what we have been offered by greedy capitalists and warlords. We have to think how to change our nightmares to beautiful dreams that one day will become a reality if we are together. Let's dream.
Hi, my name is Emma Haraki. I was born and raised in one of the suburbs of Beirut, long before it was called the suburb Dahi. But I consider Montreal home since 2015. I'm a lover of storytelling, art, and sometimes I write. The future I imagine is one that we can only envision together beyond the limits of the societies we have come to understand under capitalism. The future I imagine is a bonfire of joy and militancy. The future I imagine is dissident, brave, caring, and is built upon love. The future I imagine is a bonfire of joy and militancy. The future I imagine is dissident, brave, caring, and is built on love.
Hi, my name is Doha Mardi. I'm a Sudanese activist based in Jojage, Montreal, Canada. My hope for the future is that we live in a world where all humans can go beyond survival, where all humans are well, are healthy, and living with purpose. I hope that we continue our commitments towards collective liberation and that we live in a world where poverty is no longer present. And also, I hope that we are more in harmony with the natural world instead of a relationship of extraction and exploitation. I hope that we moved beyond capitalism, beyond patriarchy, beyond colonialism and imperialism. And I hope that those of us who are the most marginalized no longer are. I hope that we live in a world where fear is no longer what shapes our politics, what shapes our lives. I hope that we not only imagine this world, but we continue to work together creating this world. Because it is possible.
هذا وقت الشباب هذا وقت الرجال هذا وقت الأسود التي تمزق حبال نحن كوحدة قوة تقدر تحرك جبال إلى متى نخان إلى متى من حكم ديكتاتوري نهان في هذه الأرض سنة كما تدين تدان في هذه الأرض حكمة كما تعين تعان فقد حان الأوان إلى خلق النظام ومن عاش جبان فقد راض الظلام إلى متى نكون فقط قوم الكلام إلى متى نساق وفي الفم اللجام وبالفم نهان وبالهم نعان لقد سالت عيون دمعا من سيل الدمام لقد عشنا قرون على حلم السلام على حلم الأمان على قهر النظام فقد حان الأوان
لكي نقول لا للديكتاتورية لا للحكومة طالعة من ضميري صعدة للسماء. الحالة وصلت حتى والشعوب قالت كفاية, حكامنا تقرصنوا والبلطجة بقت هواية. لو كان ضميرك صاحي ما كان خفت في البداية, شوف المراية عاين حتلقى نفسك ما معايا. أنا الشعب الرفض خوف وطلع يقاوم, لو كنت فاهم الكرسي مسخرة ما شفنا مرة دايم. مزرع عرايس والخيوط في يد أبد تسالم, حبر على الورق وين الضمير تسيده نايم. ضباب كثير والمصير مجهول في الضلمة عايم. بلد مقسمة عصابة منتهى الجرائم, ديمقراطية بالاسم والقمع لسه قايم. ما بالسلاح أرد عليك يتسموك حاكم, بجملة واحدة ما برد عليك من غير شتايم. ميزنا نحن ربنا بعقل على البهايم.
كل الصعوبة الأخرى تحت رئيس خان الزمان بظل حتى في هزيمة الوحدة المنهوب.
الحرب الدينية في جنوب السودان أصبح الزاهد إلى هناك في قاتل ماشي الجنة, والمقتول من الإخوة الجنوبية من شعبنا ماشي إلى النار. لذلك هم الذين أجدوا المشاعر. حرب دينية يعني كل الضرب الثاني في بلادي أنهم قادوها لحد سنة 2005.
Yes, for love and
Hello, my name is Kumru Bilici. I am a Kurdish freelance journalist, researcher and community organizer from Turkey, living in Ottawa, Canada. I dream of a future, especially for my son, where there is no injustice, no inequality, or no hostility between the races, classes and genders. A world and community where people will empower one another by nurturing each other's differences, by being gentle to each other and towards the earth.
My name is Tarkul Mespa. I teach critical thinking.
We want a world in which many worlds fit. یک دنیایی که دنیاها توش جا بگیره. Queremos un mundo donde quepan muchos mundos.
We want a world in which many worlds fit.
که دنیاها توش جا بگیره. Queremos un mundo donde quepan muchos mundos.
My name is Hamid Farmand, children's rights activist and founder and president of non-profit organization Children of Imprisoned Parents International.
I dream a world where children can have their childhood. Childhood filled with love and peace. A world where children live with dignity and respect. A world where no child experiences any form of discrimination. A world where all children's cultures, language, beliefs, ethnicity and nationality will be recognized. A world where children will not be removed from their families except for their safety and the best interest. A world where the children's voice will be heard clearly. A world where children's life matter. I dream of a world where children can have their childhood.
Hello, my name is Kaveh Abbasian. I am from Iran. I was a student activist inside Iran. And now I live in the UK. I'm a filmmaker and a lecturer in film and media. What I hope for future, I guess I should divide my answers to, you know, the personal level and more communal level, and also on a national and more international level. On a personal level, obviously, I hope to live a healthy life, both in terms of, you know, mentally and physically. I hope I can help and assist people around me, and I hope I can continue to receive the generous help from people around me. and a more national, by which I mean Iranian level, I guess. I hope one day I can, like many others, you know, this is a hope for so many other people as well. I hope we can go back to Iran at least for a visit. I hope that becomes a possibility. And I hope that eventually divisions and bloodshed is finished and we reach a state of, you know, peace and balance, whatever and however that may be achieved. But obviously this is something that I can hope for everyone else internationally as well. I hope that wars and class society and all that kind of thing is eventually finished through whatever means that makes it possible, democratically, revolutionary, whatever. So this became too generic and obvious, and I'm sorry about this, but that's pretty much a more general and hope that I have for the future, both for myself and for everyone else. Oh, and I forgot to mention yet another generic hope for future, and that is for us as humanity to be able to live in peace and harmony and coexistence along with other animals, plants and animals, and also just generally with nature. So, a future that is sustainable and for everyone.
I'm Neda. I'm ecofeminist, ecosocialist, and agroecologist. The future that I imagine is a future that everyone is free, because we know that no one is free unless everyone is. A society which its natural resources are managing in a sustainable and regenerative way. Animals, plants, human beings, the whole ecosystem is living in a balance. There is no system of oppression against women, races, natural habitats, queer communities, and etc. Yes, the future that I imagine is a harmonized, democratic, anti-colonial ecosystem. The future that I imagine.
And Caroline Sconzel's hopes and dreams. Caroline is an artist and musician. She is also co-host and co-producer of Future Is Now. She also generously shared a song that she improvised one day a few years back while pregnant with her son Zach. Song is called The Future Is In Your Hands, and as she said, an extraterrestrial-like humorous song.
The future, I hope, for my kid, that he live in a society where the government does a good job of making sure that everyone, all of its people, have a dignified place to live, that everyone has enough to eat, and everyone has access to healthcare when they need it, regardless of their economic or social or political situation. I wish for my kid to have fresh water to drink and clean air to breathe. I hope for a future where everyone is included, everyone is treated with kindness and respect, regardless of who they are, where they came from, what size of a body or shape of a body they have, what their background is, whether they're from this or that culture, whatever their identity, their gender, that everyone is given a place and respect and freedom. And I hope this also, I'll say this because my kid loves animals, I hope for a future where humans take good care of their fellow beings. The animals on this earth are treated also with respect and dignity, and same with the plants, because we're all interconnected. That's the future I wish for my kid.
Hello, I am a voice.
Here, let's listen to the future Kayhan Tahiri is imagining, my grandson.
So pretty much my ideal world. So my ideal world would be a world where, you know, everyone can be in unity. Like, if everyone could help each other, there'd be less human problems. Like, let's say, like, the climate change or whatever, that wouldn't be a problem because we would be taking care of each other. And by taking care of each other, by default, we'll take care of the earth. And just life would be more green and life would be easier and simpler. And let's say another example, like homeless people, if everyone were just helping each other, there'd be less homeless people, which means there'd be less people starving. More people would have like jobs to do and everyone could just take care of themselves and take care of everyone, which would make life just simpler and easier instead of making it complicated by being selfish and wanting to live alone. So, yeah, that's pretty much it.
I'm Shersad Mujab, scholar, activist, which means that I've thought and taught about social change and revolution, but most importantly, have been in social movements, including women, students, justice-seeking movements of indigenous people around the world, the Kurds, Palestinians, two political prisoners, and black people, and much, much more. This also means that I've lived all my life in future. I lived today, struggled today for social change, to be able to imagine a better tomorrow, to see the future. This is not a passive waiting. This means that it is a resistance in waiting. It is an anticipatory waiting for change, for a future that I believe is absolutely possible. But what is that future? A scene, I think, in daily life that cheers me up is when I see a group of people together laughing, debating, dancing, singing, chanting, listening, creating art, or planting a garden. Ordinary life matters that is extraordinary absent as majority of people are suffering. And collective joy is a rare moment. Life mostly is not about creation and collectivity. It is about individual and destruction. This disorder is embedded in an overwhelmingly devastating order, what I call patriarchal, racist, capitalist imperialism. The future then is to transform in a major way this destructive force globally. Women and youth in particular desire this transformation all the time, hence they revolt. My life is interlocked with the 1979 revolution in Iran. I consider myself, and have repeatedly said this, that I'm a lucky feminist revolutionary, as I witnessed and participated in movements for change. Though I don't want to romanticize these movements, there have been many defeats. And these days, it feels the more my generation has fought for change and a better world, the worse the world has gotten. But I feel hope is the only possible chance that we have for a better future. This is, in a way, summarized in the last few months in the slogan of Jin Jian Azadi, Women, Life, Freedom, which is only possible, and it is also possible to realize it and maintain it under a renewed socialism, which I think that this is the future for me.
vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio dos luceros que cuando los abro perfecto distingo lo negro del blanco, y en el alto cielo su fondo estrellado, y en las multitudes el hombre que yo amo. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el sonido, el abecedario, con el las palabras que pienso y declaro, madre, amigo, hermano, y luz alumbrando la ruta del alma.
I dream of a world with no war. I dream of a world with no borders and flags to die for. I dream of a world where our forests, sea, oceans, river, and air are free from man-made poisons. I dream of a world where humankind can live in harmony and respect to nature and animals. I dream of a world where there is no hunger, there is no greed, there is no prisons, torture, and executions. I dream of a world with food, clean water, and proper home for everyone. A world where we are all free of prejudice and discrimination of any kind. I dream of a world where we all live with dignity and kindness. And no doubt that I have hope one day all these dreams will come true, all our collective dreams for a just future. We just need to start working together toward the realization of our dreams, our hopes.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio el corazón que agita su marco cuando miro el fruto del cerebro humano, cuando miro el bueno tan lejos del malo, cuando miro el fondo de tus ojos claros. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto.
If listening to this episode inspired you to talk about your own hopes and dreams for the future, please record your voice and send it to our email, zgallery2011@gmail.com. Zgallery2011, one word. Or any other way you can connect to us. You can send us through our Instagram page, Facebook page, zgallery2011. We definitely love to do more episodes echoing our hopes and dreams. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Future Is Now. I am Shahrzad Ershadi. Please don't forget to be kind. Until next time, goodbye.
You've been listening to Future Is Now, a podcast series exploring intersections between art and social change. Produced by Zed Gallery's Shahrzad Ershadi and Caroline Künzli. This project was made possible by funding from the Canada Council for the Arts.
Future is now.
This radio station is on fire.
Colt MTL's Best of MTL 2024 Readers Poll is now open for voting. This is their 12th annual poll. Best of MTL is a forum to reward your favorite local people, places, media, art, food, events, and services. Vote for CKUT 90.3 FM as the best radio station in the city. Polls are open now until this Sunday at 11:59 p.m. on the dot. That's April 14th, 2024, so get voting right now. You can go vote at coltmtl.com.
Hi there, it's Anita Johnson, and just a quick request before we get started. Please rate us on iTunes or wherever you catch our podcast. That helps other people to find us. And of course, give us a high rating. Thanks, and here's the show.
That's coming from grassroots level.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamarani, and on today's Making Contact.
By the late 1930s, by the early 1940s, it was perfectly clear that to create a Jewish state in an Arab country would require the dispossession of a very large proportion of the Arab population. And that's what happened in 1948.
We talked to Rashid Khalidi about his new book, The Hundred Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance.
Israel has created a situation where no one is going to be able to take control of Gaza and where there's likely to be continued resistance in the West Bank for an indefinite period.
Stay tuned. All that and more coming up.
The past week, mainly over the weekend, Israel has intensified its strikes, airstrikes on various parts of the territory, including the southern, the middle, the northern Gaza Strip, as well as Gaza City, which has been...
Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamarani. You're listening to the voice of Rami Almagari. Rami has reported from Gaza for decades for Pacifica Radio and for us here at Making Contact.
As the Israeli army has stormed already the Al-Shifa Hospital, which is a major hospital in the Gaza Strip, where a few thousands of people have been stranded there, including patients.
Rami was forced to flee his family home in northern Gaza when the Israeli bombing began. And for a while, he was sending us audio reports of the situation around Palestine.
In fact, other developments in Gaza have been unfolding coincidentally as Israeli airstrikes have hit.
This one is from November of 2023.
For the third time, the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza Strip, they hit nearby the hospital, around the hospital.
Rami, like many Palestinians, is effectively now a refugee on his own land. Over 30,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli troops since October 7th, and Gaza is currently the most dangerous place on earth to be a journalist.
That is the situation on the ground in the Gaza Strip for the time being. Rami Almagari for Making Contact, Gaza Strip.
If you've listened to most of the Western press, the focus is on October 7th as the beginning of the war. But the war in Palestine started decades ago, before October 7th, before the Intifadas or the Camp David Accords, even before World War II. And if we really want to understand what's happening in Gaza right now, we have to understand that very early history, which is when Zionists first set their sights on Palestine. And to be honest, it wasn't a history that I knew all that much about. So I sat down for an interview with Rashid Khalidi.
I teach at Columbia University, where I'm the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies.
Because I just read his book, The 100 Years War in Palestine. And Rashid said he had some specific reasons for writing this book. First, he wanted a more accessible account of Palestinian history, so not so academic. But he also wanted to combat some misconceptions.
I had a very strong thesis that this is not a conflict that's been going on since time immemorial. It's a conflict caused by imperialism and the rise of modern nationalism, that there was no hostility between Arabs and Jews before the rise of Zionism and of modern Arab nationalism, and the intrusion of British imperialism into the Middle East after World War I. And finally, that Israel, while it represents a national project of Zionism, was established as a settler colonial project, and that those two things are actually not contradictory.
And for today, we're going to focus on a pivotal piece of Palestinian history, the very early Zionist movement and the subsequent settling of Palestine with the help of the British and later on the United States. And we hope that today's interview will help us to understand how we got to where we are today. Rashid, to start, let's talk about the idea of Zionism, because for many of us in the modern world, we've come to perceive Zionism as a decolonial movement or even an indigenous one. But you argue in your book that actually, in the beginning, Zionism had no problems calling itself a colonial endeavor, and that Zionists even aligned themselves with the big colonial powers of the time. So talk to me about Zionism as a colonial movement, and then how it rebranded itself into a decolonial one.
Absolutely. I mean, the founder of modern political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, made no bones about it. At one point, he said something like, "We'll be a barrier for Europe against the barbarism of Asia." So they saw themselves as Europeans, persecuted in Europe, but nevertheless European. And they described what they were doing in terms of colonialism. I quote Zionist leaders in the 1920s, I quote in particular Zev Jabotinsky, who's the founder of probably the most influential trend in Zionism since the 1970s, the revisionist trend, which, you know, fathered the Likud party, which has dominated Israeli politics for the last 40 or 50 years. And he was quite explicit in talking about this as a colonial endeavor. He was quite explicit in talking and understanding that any colonization necessarily produces resistance by the indigenous population.
Jabotinsky argued in an article written in 1923 that Arabs would never peacefully cede their land because no indigenous people have ever ceded their land to colonizers without a fight. He even explicitly compared Zionism to the kind of settler colonialism seen in the Americas.
And the fact that people dodge and weave around the idea of this project being a colonial one means that they're completely ignoring the writings of people like Herzl, the writings of people like Jabotinsky, and the self-perception of the early Zionist movement. One of the most important land purchase agencies was something called the Jewish Colonization Agency, later rebranded as the Palestine Jewish Colonization Agency. It existed until 1958. So that was not just how other people perceived this, Palestinians or other Arabs. That's how they perceived themselves. I mean, they saw they had a claim to the land. They believed their claim, you know, entitled them to do whatever they wanted. And they intended to establish a Jewish state in a predominantly Arab land on the basis of that claim, but operating as a settler colonial project. Now, what happens in World War II, which is the beginning of the era of decolonization, is a switch by the Zionist movement. Having been backed by the British up until World War II, in an era where colonialism and settler colonialism were in good odor in the world. I mean, the League of Nations and the great powers considered colonialism a good thing. And so Zionism had no problem in self-identifying as a colonial movement. But the Zionist movement fell out with the British after the British changed their policy in 1939. And from that point on, when they were in conflict with the British, they began to see themselves as an anti-colonial movement and to rebrand themselves and sell themselves as anti-colonialists who struggled against British imperialism. British imperialism established the Zionist pre-state. British imperialism made possible an increase in the Jewish population of Palestine from about 6% to 31% between 1917 and 1939. So the idea that this was not the spoiled stepchild of colonialism and British imperialism is absurd. But that rebranding was very successful in the era of decolonization.
So do you think that, I mean, yes, it was a colonial movement from the jump, but do you think that all of the early Zionist settlers realized that they would have to violently crush the Arabs in order to maintain land?
Not at the beginning. I think there was a lot of self-delusion. In his diary, Herzl wrote that we will spirit the poor population across the borders discreetly, so that they understood that what they were trying to do was an embarrassing thing, to remove the indigenous population, but they intended to do that. Now, he said, spirit them across the frontiers, implying that that could be done easily, presumably with bribery or other inducements.
Early Zionists might have been optimistic that the indigenous Arabs that they were displacing would calmly move out of their homes and off of their land. But the idea of benevolent displacement didn't last long, if it was even real in the first place. Of course, the Palestinians resisted and began fighting back.
they understood that, that as Jabotinsky wrote in that 1923 article, the objective was to transform Palestine into the land of Israel. And that meant their dispossession. This is pictured as the irrational Muslim hatred of Jews or some other absurd, in some other absurd fashion. But in fact, it was, as Jabotinsky pointed out, this is the natural resistance of an indigenous population to a colonial project. And so over time, the more hard-headed Zionists like David Ben-Gurion, who later on became the first prime minister of Israel, recognized that forcible removal of the population, the euphemism that was favored from the 30s onwards was transfer. What it meant was expulsion and ethnic cleansing, dispossession, would be necessary. So by the late 1930s, by the early 1940s, it was perfectly clear that to create a Jewish state in an Arab country, in a country that as late as 1948 had a 65 or 66% Arab majority, would require the dispossession of a very large proportion of the Arab population. And that's what happened in 1948.
1948 was a year of the Nakba, which we've covered a lot here at Making Contact. The Nakba, or the catastrophe, was the mass displacement and ethnic cleansing of Arabs living in Palestine in order to make way for the state of Israel.
You couldn't have done what Israel did in order to create a majority Jewish state, failing, you know, the kind of massive immigration they had been hoping for in the 20s and the 30s. The Jewish population as a proportion of the whole increased, it's true, from 7% to about 31% by 1939, but that wasn't a majority. And so force was necessary.
Yeah, and I mean, sort of relatedly, I've heard Netanyahu in the past talking about Arabs in some pretty racist ways, and this is far before October 7th, much as colonial empires view the people that they're subjugating. And so there's this contradiction sometimes in the way that Zionists talk about themselves as being indigenous to the Middle East, and yet viewing the Arab world as inferior and barbarous.
Well, I mentioned Herzl talking about a barrier against the barbarism of Asia. I mean, that idea that we are Europeans and we represent enlightenment and they are non-Europeans and they represent darkness, if you want, was, how should I say, extremely widespread among Europeans. And that was the worldview that European Jews shared with other Europeans, a racist view based on a sense of superiority over the natives, over the indigenous peoples.
Right. And that's also interesting because there were already Jewish people living in Palestine, but they weren't, I guess, European Jews. There were Jewish communities who were predominantly Arab in culture. Is that right?
That's correct. Most of the Jewish population of Palestine were, in fact, Mizrahi Jews, Eastern Jews, either indigenous Jewish populations that had been there for enormously lengthy periods of time, sometimes always been there, or other immigrants to Palestine from places like Yemen or other Arab countries, as well as many Ashkenazi Jews who had come for reasons of prayer or study or pilgrimage and who had stayed. And so you had a non-Zionist, in many cases anti-Zionist, Jewish population. The majority of the Jewish population of Palestine right up to World War I probably fit into that category. The number of European Jews who came there for political reasons inspired by Zionism were still probably a minority as late as World War I. And you're right, as far as Arab Jews were concerned, whether in Iraq or in Palestine or in Syria or Lebanon or elsewhere, generally speaking, they shared the culture, the language, the cuisine of their Muslim and Christian neighbors. They spoke Arabic. They were separated by religion, obviously, but they shared the same culture, generally speaking.
So, Rashid, we've covered some of the early ideals of the Zionist movement in terms of its colonial aspirations. But the early Zionist movement was small, and colonizing an entire territory requires a lot of arms and money. So talk to me about how Zionists began seeking out colonial funding or colonial backers. And I'm especially interested in why the British decided to support Israel so strongly.
The primary reason was strategic. The British, since early in the 20th century, had been worried about the defense of the eastern frontier of Egypt, which was a vital stepping stone on the route to India. And the empire, the crown and the jewel of the empire was India. And so control of the Suez Canal, which runs through Egypt, was absolutely vital strategically to the British Empire. And British planners and strategists and generals and the Committee of Imperial Defense were all worked up by around 1905, 1906, with the problem of the defense of Egypt from the east. And Palestine, as the country to the east, was the focus of their concern. The other important strategic factor is that Palestine is at the Mediterranean terminus of the shortest land route between the Mediterranean and the Gulf. And in that same period, the British were realizing that the building of a railway would enable transport quite rapidly between Europe and the Mediterranean and the Gulf and the Indian Ocean. And they wanted to control that shortest land route, just as they controlled the Suez Canal, and for the same reasons. And so when you look at the Sykes-Picot partition frontiers of 1915, 1916, you see a strip of land running from Palestine across to Basra under British control, which is the, how should I say, the instantiation of that British strategic priority that Britain must control not just the shortest sea route, but also the shortest land route. That's the reason they were interested in Palestine. And the Zionist movement came along and they developed a transactional relationship. We will support your project in exchange for our using that as the pretext for our being in Palestine. In the words of a British official who was actually the first military governor of Jerusalem, a man named Sir Ronald Storrs, what Britain was trying to establish was a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of hostile Arabs. And I think that sort of sums it up.
We're about to head into a break, but stay tuned. We have a lot more to discuss with Rashid Khalidi about his book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. We're just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, please visit us online at radioproject.org for show links and behind-the-scenes information, or to leave us a comment. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamrani, and today we're talking about Rashid Khalidi and his book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. In the first half of the show, we looked at the early Zionist movement as a colonial endeavor and how the British became its primary benefactor. Without its help, Israel would not exist today, or at least the mass migration to Israel that slowly displaced the Palestinians could not have happened. However, although Israel still received support from the British government, the United Kingdom is not Israel's primary supporter. That, of course, is the United States. So, Rashid, Great Britain had been a huge supporter of Israel. What happened? Why did Great Britain lose interest?
Well, this is before the establishment of Israel, but the Jewish Agency, which had been established by the British as a sort of quasi-government, Zionist quasi-government of the Jewish population of Palestine, switched because the British had switched. And the British switched for reasons linked to the original strategic reasons that had made them want to control Palestine. By 1939, they had had enormous difficulty in mastering a massive nationwide Palestinian revolt that had lasted from 1936 to 1939, which had required the sending of over 100,000 British troops and police to Palestine, and which had cost a fortune to the British exchequer, and had only been suppressed with the greatest difficulty. Between 14 and 17% of the adult male Palestinian population were either killed, wounded, interned, or arrested, or exiled. And the British realized by 1939 that they were on the brink of World War II. There was a restive Arab population in Palestine. There was fury and rage throughout the Arab world, and in fact, far beyond in the Muslim world, including in India, about what Britain had done in Palestine. And the British realized we're going to have to fight in the Middle East. We're going to have to fight Mussolini. We're going to have to fight Hitler. They could see the war coming. And so Britain changed its policy. It had to cater to Arab sentiments. It had to cater to sentiment in India. Secretary of State for India and the Viceroy are writing the cabinet and telling them, this is an Indian problem now. What you are doing in Palestine is a problem for us in India. They could not send Indian troops to quell the Palestinian uprising because they couldn't be sure of their loyalty. There was so much support and sympathy for the Palestinians in India. And I think that's an indication of the strategic reasons for which Britain changes course. And in 1939, issues what's called a white paper, in which they limited Jewish immigration, which had been unlimited up to that point. They limited Jewish land purchase, which had been unlimited up to that point. And they shifted for the first time to talking about an independent Palestine, which would have had an Arab majority. Now, there were all kinds of poison pills in this, which meant it probably never would have taken place. But from the Zionist perspective, this was a betrayal. The Zionists always read the pledge in the Balfour Declaration of a Jewish national home as a Jewish state. And in fact, Lord Balfour and Lloyd George and Churchill had assured Weizmann that that's what they meant when they said a Jewish national home. They meant when you have a majority, you take it over, it's yours. And so they, in their disappointment and in their anger, you had the beginning of a rebellion in the Jewish community in Palestine against the British and a search for new patrons. The Zionist Project needed a new patron. They tried the Germans and the French before World War I. They had succeeded with the British during World War I. And during World War II, they managed to find two exceedingly powerful patrons, which were the United States and the Soviet Union. And those are the powers that ended up backing the establishment of Israel through a General Assembly resolution in 1947.
At the time, the United States was not the global power that it is now, but the U.S. already had a deep interest in Zionism.
The main motivation, I would argue, was electoral and strategic for the United States taking the approach that it did after World War II. The United States wanted a foothold in the Middle East. The United States wanted to ease the British out and take their place. The United States was very impressed, in particular, once the Arab-Israeli war started, with the military prowess of the new Israeli army. And so whether it was oil companies or the Defense Department or others, as well as the president, who had his own electoral concerns, different parts of the U.S. government saw alignment with Israel as advantageous to the United States. Truman famously once said, before 1948, to a group of American diplomats who were serving in different Arab capitals, and who said to the president that he should moderate his support of Zionism. He said, gentlemen, I have many constituents who are concerned for the success of Zionism. I don't have any who are concerned for the Arabs. And that was an electoral consideration for a president who barely got elected in 1948. And so that for him was a factor, as it was a factor for LBJ, as it is a factor for Joe Biden. You cannot ignore the electoral importance of this issue for certain important segments of voters and certain important segments of donors, especially to the Democratic Party, but now also to the Republican Party.
Yeah, you know, when I was reading that section about how the U.S. became interested in Israel, what really stood out to me was how good the Zionist movement was at reading the global stage, courting Turkey, or I guess at that time, the Ottoman Empire, Great Britain, and then knowing or seeing that the U.S. was becoming a huge colonial power and easily sort of wooing American politicians. That's something that the Palestinians just weren't able to do very easily.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the shrewdness of the Zionist leadership before the establishment of Israel and of Israeli leaders since then in sensing shifts in the global balance of power is really quite remarkable. Of course, it's a function of the fact that they understand that the project is dependent on outside support. You cannot establish a Jewish state in a majority Arab country and keep that Arab majority out and keep them, hold them down and resist support for them by their Arab neighbors, unless you have massive external support. They have to be sensitive. They had to be from the moment of the establishment of modern political Zionism, and they have to be today, during the Gaza War, extremely sensitive, at least to the support of the United States and the former colonial powers in Europe, who are, in effect, the metropole of this colonial project, the center. Without that center, Israel is a powerful independent state. It has nuclear weapons. It is the fourth largest army in the world. It's technologically superior in many ways. It has a huge army. We're seeing four divisions in Gaza, several divisions along the Lebanese frontier. How many armies have 8 or 10 or 12 divisions? And yet it is dependent, completely dependent in some respects, on external support. Israel would be in dire shape were it not for American vetoes in the Security Council. The Israeli artillery would not have shells to fire were it not for the United States. And so this remarkable prescience and concern about the international balance of power is a function of the absolute dependence of the Zionist project, and since then, of the state of Israel, on external support, from specifically from the United States and Western Europe.
There's a lot more in Rashid Khalidi's book, The 100 Years War in Palestine, and you can find links to his work on our website. But we wanted to end here because right now, for the first time, the colonial backing that Israel has normally depended on is under threat.
We are here today because we are absolutely disgusted by our government's involvement in this genocide. And yes, it is very much a genocide when every single member of your community has lost multiple family members.
We're speaking to each other at a time of you know, terrible anguish in Gaza and in Palestine and among people who have any kind of moral sense. At the time we're talking to each other, there seems to be no end in sight.
Protests around the world have reignited an interest in Palestine and the history of the Zionist movement there.
Clash overnight between police and protesters blocking one of Australia's biggest ports. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators targeting an Israeli ship docked in Port Botany in Sydney.
It doesn't really matter what anybody on this stage says today, because the greatest message that could be delivered is from you, the tens of thousands of people who came to this city in the greatest show of international solidarity that Ireland has seen in many years.
There have even been open allegations of genocide against the Israeli government. So to end, we want to talk about what that means for the region.
I think that Israel has sowed the seeds of a disastrous situation for itself in terms of more intensive occupation of the West Bank, and intensification of colonization of the West Bank, and what will inevitably be a reoccupation of Gaza, I think. Israel has created a situation where no one is going to be able to take control of Gaza from Israel, and where there's likely to be continued resistance in the West Bank, probably armed resistance in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip for an indefinite period. Whatever happens militarily, whether Israel succeeds in defeating the armed resistance in the Gaza Strip, it won't end resistance there. There's no way it can do that. In fact, it's probably generated a whole new wave of people who will rise up against the occupation. 75,000 people have been killed and wounded so far. I mean, there are 20,000 people dead. There are 7,000 or 8,000 people missing. Most of them are dead. There are, I believe, around 50,000 people wounded. So we're talking about 75,000 people, and the war is nowhere near over. We could have many, many more killed and wounded and maimed and missing. And that will generate enormous anger and hostility among Palestinians for a very long period going forward.
The numbers cited by Rashid are from late last year when we first talked. That number is a lot higher now. And it's also important to note that Israel's long-term strategy is unclear. But one thing is certain, and it's something that Jabotinsky pointed out in that 1923 article we mentioned at the beginning of the show. Whether or not Hamas is overthrown, the war will probably create a bigger, stronger, and more determined resistance.
Where that leads, I don't know. What the impact of that on the Arab world is, I don't know. You have in the Arab world regimes that are based on repression of what their people want and not allowing them to express themselves. Most of these regimes, whether they're